Rembrandt Harmes van Rijn was a Dutch painter of the 17th century. He was more than a Dutch painter. He was the most famous Dutch painter of all times. That's not the slightest doubt of it, about that. Whether he was the most famous painter of all times is something which can be argued, because we get into a matter of aesthetics and various value scales which contain intangibles. So this is something which I certainly do not want to argue about. I personally have no clear-cut opinion. He is one of the great giants of art of all times. And he is undoubtedly the greatest etcher who has ever lived. His etchings, which have come down to us, are absolutely fabulous. Now, his work has come down to us particularly in three modes of expression. First, in drawings. These were sketches which he made, and there are some 1,400 drawings which have come down to our times. And then the etchings, and then the paintings. And I will go into this, of course, to some detail later on. I want to tell you first about his life. He was born in Leiden in Holland in 1606, and he died in 1669, which is exactly 300 years ago. It is for that reason there is now a great interest in Rembrandt again. My interest has persisted all through my lifetime, which is, of course, something which I owe to my parents and to the cultural climate in Europe and in a university town in which I was brought up. So Rembrandt was always quite close to me. All right, he was born in Leiden in Holland in 1606 as the son of an owner of a windmill. You know, these Dutch windmills, and so the father was neither poor nor rich, he was just a middle-class man. And Rembrandt very early expressed the desire to become a painter. And at the age of 13, which is 1 year older than this boy who was running around here, this German boy, he was apprenticed to some forgotten master of whom we know very little, and he certainly had a very feeble influence on Rembrandt, whose talent was then just starting to develop, but who needed some direction. And at the age of 17, that is 4 years later, he was apprenticed to Lastman, who was a painter of a somewhat higher order. There are some works of Lastman which have survived to our times, and for the specialists, of course I'm not a specialist, it's interesting to find out how much Rembrandt's work is actually influenced by Lastman, and at what time and to what extent and to what degree he exceeded his master. The major city in Holland at that time was Amsterdam. Amsterdam, located on the Scheldt, on the navigable river, where the ships came from all parts of the world, because at that time Holland was a rich country, a wealthy country. It was quite independent, had thrown off the yoke of the Catholic Spanish emperors, and it had become a, quote, Dutch Reformed Church, that is, a church which was quite independent. It was Calvinistic, and in this environment of a rich city with wealthy burghers, but also with a Jewish ghetto and with many beggars and poor people, in this milieu, in this setting, Rembrandt moved at the age of 24. And his star was in the ascending. He was a very good painter, and so his fame spread very quickly among the rich burghers. They loved to be painted by him. He got commission after commission. His wealth increased, and his fame spread. He etched, he made etchings, and these etchings were sold for quite some money, and this spread his fame beyond his city there and beyond his country, and he became well known. So he accumulated wealth, he moved into a big house, which was right adjacent to the ghetto, so he had a chance to observe the Jews, small ones, large ones, men and women, in the activities. He became friendly with the rabbis, which later on served him as models for his religious work. And At the age of 28, he married Saskia van Oudenborg, who was a wealthy heiress. He was now a fashionable painter, and so this woman became his wife, and it was a very, very festive and wonderful and joyous, if not to say a riotous time for Rembrandt. In Dresden, which is now in East Germany, in communist East Germany, is a fabulous painting, very famous, in which he sits in the attire of a knight with a sword dangling on his side, and on his knees sits his bride, Saskia, all beautifully adorned, and he has a large glass of champagne, which he holds high up in his hand, and he toasts to his bride and to the wonderful, happy life. Beautiful painting. I've seen it as a child. I've never seen it since Germany was divided, and I don't have the slightest interest to go to communist Germany and to throw my good dollars to the communists. So this picture is something which I won't see anymore. Now this happy state, of course, could not endure. Rembrandt was completely oblivious to money, and he bought pearls, brocades, all kinds of fanciful things on which his eye had set, and used these trappings and these things to adorn his subjects who sat for him, including himself. There are quite a few self-portraits where he has a turban and in all kinds of fantastic brocades, you see. And so this went on not very long. One reason was, and I think that's an interesting reason, is that he antagonized his patrons. Up to Rembrandt, it was customary, if somebody commissioned a painter to paint him, that he was painted with as much likeness as possible, like a photograph, and usually en face, that is, to seem right from the front. Rembrandt didn't go for that. For him, the human figure, whether this human figure paint him or not, was just an object for study of the human person, in addition to study of light and shadow, and study of all kinds of subtle ideas which are typically of interest to a painter, but which are of no interest whatsoever to the patron who holds the bag. So one of the most glaring mistakes, in quote, which Rembrandt made was to paint the anatomy of Dr. Kulp. Dr. Kulp was a famous physician, and there were quite a few young, not so young, wealthy MDs and would-be MDs who clustered around Kulp while he was dissecting a body. Now, up to that time, when such paintings, such group paintings were commissioned, it was expected that everyone would be en face, that is from front, everybody would stare out of the picture, so his likeness would be caught for all future times. Rembrandt painted a picture in which Dr. Kulp was exclusively interested in bending over this corpse and watching his surgical work, which he did. And all the other fellows who stood around, they didn't look at the spectator out of the frame. They looked at either at the body or they looked at Kulp. And this caused a wild tempest of excitement and objection, you see. It is incidentally one of his most famous paintings, you see, because for the first time there was life, there was a situation which was caught in its immediacy. And in addition, these individuals are magnificent portraits, but they are not from the front anymore, they are from the sides or from the half sides. Now this is about the same if a liturgy has been used for 150 years and suddenly somebody comes and turns everything upside down. Of course there is resentment and there is excitement. And for him, it was just shown in a falling office of commissions. And in addition to that, of course, he didn't care a hoot about money. So there were debtors who came and who asked for payment because they knew that, his stars seemed to be in the wane. And so, of course, all these things came on him at the same time. And on top of that, Saskia, who had given him 4 children, 3 of whom had died. As it was quite customary before our times, there was no inoculation and all these things, you see. So the children died very early in infancy. One son, Titus, survived. So Saskia died. Now this was, of course, a terrific blow. In addition to his financial difficulties and difficulties with his patrons and his clients or whatever you may call, his beloved wife had died. So there was a great blow. But Rembrandt kept on working undauntedly. He painted many self-portraits. He etched many self-portraits. He drew many self-portraits working in front of a mirror. And you can see, like in a mirror, which is quite corny because he used the mirror, of course, to portray himself, you can see the gradual change of his face. In the first and early works, like in this Dresden picture, where he is a young, strutting, upcoming fellow, from there to the very end of his life, where he is bent and the face all with the folds and with all the signs of age, which he carefully painted and depicted without prettifying himself at all. You see, he tried to fathom the deepest psychological changes which were reflected by his face, and so this gradual going on through his life, from this early unconcern to the deep concern and to the misery and to all the tribulations he had to go through, were faithfully reflected in these many self-portraits. So, after the death of Saskia, he took a young, uneducated girl into his house, Henrike Stoffels, who cared for him and cared for Saskia's and Rembrandt's son, Titus. And she became his common law wife, and he has painted her innumerable times, drawn her, etched her, and she is in his pictures, of course, very frequently. He loved her dearly, she loved him very dearly. I mean, these were historical figures. He lived less than 300 years ago, you see, so we know all these things. The conditions, the economic conditions deteriorated continuously. And finally, he had to declare bankruptcy, and all these gimmicks, all the stuff which he had accumulated, all these brocades and the gold stuff and pearls and God knows what, had all to be auctioned off, and the lists still have been preserved and come down to our times in the archives with in certain Mr. Rembrandt van Rijn and on the auction, this was auctioned off for so and so much. And I mean, we have quite some good records what's happened. Then, in 1663, Henrike died. And in 1668, Titus died, his much beloved son. So Rembrandt was left completely without anybody close to him. And he lived a few more years. He died in 1669 at the age of 63 in complete poverty and seclusion. But he worked on to his very end. He drew, he painted self-portraits, ravaged face and so on. Magnificent work, extremely moving and touching work. So, this is just a very rough outline of his life. And I will discuss his work. His work has come down to us in drawings. There are about 1,400 drawings which are considered authentic. Again, a big subject for specialists. Is this Rembrandt's drawing? Is this from one of his disciples? Did he start it and did somebody then fudge it up or so? Of course, unending work, you see, in every magazine of the art world, there are articles dealing with the subject. This is totally outside of my sphere of interest, but there are 1,400 drawings which are more or less considered as authentic work. Now, these drawings are sketches which he made, either when he walked through landscapes, with this flat landscape, somewhat monotonous landscape of Holland, where there is not a single mountain. There are many watercourses, and there are dikes on both sides. There are these quaint bridges, there are these windmills. There are groups of trees, there are thatched houses, there are cities, which there are these church spires, and there are boats, and there are people on the field, and there are cows on the field. All these scenes he sketched with rapid and sure sketches in a few minutes, we suppose, and then he took them home And he may or may not use them for making an etching. He used them in paintings. He may make a painting which depicts entirely landscape, but he may make a religious painting in which this landscape is in the background, you see. So these were the landscape sketches. Then, of course, he sketched innumerable people. He sketched them as they were. He didn't prettify them and he didn't uglify them. And he did not use his portraits, his sketches of beggars and rabbis and wealthy burghers and whoever came into his sight, into his vision. He didn't use them as a means for social expression, either social satire, castigating people whom he didn't like, or building up people whom he liked, like George Grosz, German expatriate in the Nazi time here, of quite some fame and notoriety, whose work was exclusively social critique, a very acid social critique. Far from that, Rembrandt drew the people with his sure hand, with his unbelievably sure strokes, the way he saw them, partly just to preserve it, partly because he may use these figures again in religious drawings when the lame and the halt and the blind came to Christ, you see. So he had plenty of subjects around in these cities because, like in the times of Christ, you see, the sanitary conditions were probably just as bad. It is only in our 19th and 20th century that we have tiled bathrooms, you know, and all this monkey business, you see. So there were plenty of such people around, and he drew them and he painted them. Now then there are drawings which were compositions. That is, he had in his mind religious works and or mythological works, and so he made sketches how the figures should be arranged, one group here, one group there, counterbalancing each other and all these things. And that's of course very fascinating to study these various sheets, these various drawings. They were incidentally made with a pen or with a pencil or with a brush, with watercolor, very quick sepia touches, and then was some white dab on it, white crayon. You see, they are mixed media, you see, but it was all done very rapidly. In these drawings, this was his own personal possession. He didn't sell them. I mean, these were his drawings. They were found in his, when he died, you see, they were preserved, and they are most treasured things now in the great museums of all the world, and of course very wealthy collector who have the money to buy an original Rembrandt drawing, of course they hold on to that for a dear life, which includes nobility. There are quite a few of these in the possession of the family of the King and Queen of England and so on. Now these are the drawings. Then the second big group of his works are etching, and as I said before, Rembrandt was probably the most fabulous etcher of all times. Now, to know what etching is, I may just get technical for a few minutes, which I hope you won't take amiss. You take a copper plate. Now, wait a minute. Before I talk about etching, I want to talk about engraving. Engraving is a much older technique. Engraving, maybe you can shut that off. Engraving was used by professional copyists to copy paintings for books.
We can't hear in here. You better wait a little bit because we can't hear. That's okay.
He doesn't count the things. He has twice inundated my bathroom. Everything from my razor, my Kleenexes were all wet, and so on. Now he tries here to flood us out here. Well, that's too much. Attacked with the water hose. So the engraver, the professional engraver, which started to do their work in the 14th century, engraved with a sharp steel tool a plate, a copper plate. They dug into this copper plate with force and got lines into this plate, you see? And this was done by professional people who were not artists, who were craftsmen, to reproduce paintings for illustrations in books. And we have our bank notes engraved. In Washington, D.C., it's the Bureau of Printing and Engraving. So this is engraving. These ditches, which were dug with a sharp tool into the plate, were then filled with printer's ink, and so you printed this then on paper, black on white. Okay, this was engraving. Now what Rembrandt did, and an art which she did not conceive, but in which she contributed very definitely in its development and its refinement, was etching. And etching is done the following way. You take a copper plate, and on this copper plate you pour a mixture of rosin, colophonium, and beeswax. You melt that, and then you pour that over. And then you hold it over a fire and get black soot on it, black carbon black, you see? All right. And then you take a very sharp needle, and with this needle you draw lightly, in contradistinction to the engraving where you have the stylus, where you dig into the flame, you just draw lightly like if you would draw with a pencil on a piece of paper. And this is sufficient to remove this wax layer, and the red copper comes through. You see then the red base through your black top layer, and you draw like, as I said, like with a pencil. It's an art in which you have much greater freedom. Then, when you are finished, you take this plate and put it into an acid bath. And the acid then eats out the copper at the point where the copper has been laid bare, but it does not attack it where it is protected by this wax layer. And after you had it in the acid bath for a certain time, I don't know how long, and you have different acids, and you have different concentrations, and these were all things where Rembrandt and his contemporaries were playing around with to get the sharpness of the etching greater or less great, more diffuse or more sharp. So after this is done, then you melt off the protective layer, or you remove it with turpentine or something like that, and then you are ready for printing. You again take printer's ink and wipe that over, and of course then the printer's ink is now in the ditches which have not been dug by the tool, but which had been etched in, bitten in by the acid. All right. Now this is an etching. What Rembrandt did was to take such etched plate, and nobody prevented him from taking an engraver's tool and do some corrective strokes with the engraver's tool. So these, and this is again something for a specialist to be very fascinated by that, that it is an etching, but there are certain parts which later on have been engraved, you see. They have been retouched, so to speak, by the engraver's tool, you see. And to be again some very technical, there are what is called states. There are several states of a famous etching. The first state is when he takes the engraved, the etched plate and makes the first impression. That's state number one. But then he looks at it and he says, no, I'm going to change a bit. And then he takes his tool and he engraves a few lines. Or he may sprinkle some stuff on top, and in this way he can get a mottled background which gives some impression of half tones, you see. He makes another print or several prints. That is the second state, you see. And then he may take acid and he etches out the whole part. So the plate will get a little bit thinner, but very, very inconsequentially thinner. And inasmuch as the paper against which you press it rests on, say, some comparatively resilient stuff, it will all reproduce. So in this etched out thing, he makes then a new etching, or he makes a new engraving. So you have of these plates several states, three or four or five, and in the real deep books of art, you will say sheet so-and-so, Christ preaching, second state, you see, and then third state, you see. So that's again for a specialist to see that there are subtle changes until the artist finally thought, that's it, that's the last word. And then, of course, there were a number of prints made, several hundred, but of course each subsequent print is a tiny, tiny little bit less good than the previous, because these plates wear out. That's a copper plate, and while copper is hard, it is not super hard. It was much later, in later centuries, that one learned the art to put steel on a copper plate, and in this way, then you could make many, many more imprints. At time of Rembrandt, this was not the case. At time of Rembrandt, you had only copper. Now, please come to a conclusion here in your dialogue. Now, obviously, such prints give only black and white. They do not give half tones. But to suggest half tones, you have techniques like hatching. You make a number of lines, either closer together, then it gets darker, or farther apart, then you get a lighter background. And you can cross-hatch it with another set of lines. And in this way, you can really, though you use only the two colors, or the two shades, black and white, if nothing in between, you can suggest the most interesting transition in half tones. You see, that it is a very fascinating technique and a very fascinating medium. Now, this is so much about the etchings. His third and probably best known medium are paintings, which were always oil on canvas. There were no frescoes. And they are something very interesting. Rembrandt used quite a few colors in his paintings. But the paintings had been all preserved, protected by varnish. And not only by one layer of varnish, but subsequent generations put on another protective layer of varnish. And this varnish has yellowed through the ages. And it is because of this yellow varnish that most of the Rembrandt paintings have this brown sheen, and you think that Rembrandt has always painted only in this reddish, yellowish, and brownish colors. This is not the case. It was only the 20th century, my lifetime, your lifetime, that it was discovered that the original colors were buried under these layers of varnish. And now the varnish is removed more and more with greatest care of these precious, unique, and priceless paintings. And what came out of it is shown here in this Saskia as Flora, as the goddess of flower. This is a painting after the layer has been removed. So this, I think, is a very, very exciting thing. Some of the paintings in Amsterdam, the Rijksmuseum, have been now restored, and they gleam, of course, with colors which nobody had ever expected. Now, Rembrandt was particularly interested not only in the physiognomy of the people and to get their faces with all their emotions, with all their past life history, but he was also very much interested in light effects. And Rembrandt is the one who has, for the first time, in the most effective way, used light to bring out things which he intended to do. Now I have here, just a moment, I have to look for that. No, I may find it later. Woman Caught in Adultery, beautiful, famous painting in the National Gallery in London, in which the light is not concentrated on the figure of Christ, but is concentrated on the adulteress. And the adulteress is in a white garment, while Jesus, in all humanity, stands in a brown garment in the center of the picture, yes. But the light, the spot, is concentrated on the woman in white. A very fabulous impression. And this is something in which Rembrandt excelled. I don't find it, but I just want to mention it. Now, what are his subjects? What did he draw? What did he etch? What did he paint? His subjects were everything. I think I alluded to that, but I want to say it once more. He painted everything under the sun, from the most humble pig, beautiful etching of a pig, as I can show you, to the most elevated religious composition, deposition from the cross, and something like that. Innumerable portraits, including portraits of his father, his mother, and these many, many self-portraits, and portraits of his patrons, as long as he had them. Landscapes, of course, and he painted quite, and drew and etched quite a number of religious works. And this is interesting, because he lived at the place and at the era of the Dutch Reformed Church, and the Dutch Reformed Church frowned upon any embellishment of service. They frowned upon organ music, and they frowned on paintings and any adornment which would distract from the preaching of the word and from the reading of the scripture. And as a consequence, he did not get any permission from the church or from a church, as it had been customary for centuries in Christendom. You see, all the work of Renaissance, all the innumerable Marys with the Christ Child, and all these saints, and all these fabulous works, not only of the Renaissance, but of the Baroque later on, were commissioned by the church to adorn altars or side altars or something like that, the rooms of cardinals. You see, Rembrandt, the religious work which he did, he painted on his own religious impulse, and not for sale. I mean, certainly not for sale to a church. If somebody wants to have it, fine, you see. But he did quite a bit of religious work, and this, of course, to Ossian Roden, is of greater importance than pigs or beggars, you see. But of course, it is this religious work which I particularly recommend you to study. He started with the Old Testament. He had many Old Testament scenes and Old Testament situations which, to him, were a situation worthy to be painted. You see, they had for him a character which excited his painting instinct. And so he painted it, he drew it, he sketched it, then he etched it, and maybe he painted it. There are a number of fabulous works. Now, let me show you this one here. This is the Sacrifice of Abraham. And you see Abraham just in the left hand, he has the knife with which he is just about ready to slay his son. And he holds his right hand over his son's eyes so that in this terrible moment he doesn't see what is going on. The whole idea is, of course, heart-rending, not only to slay your own child, which is story all right, but to slay your firstborn. That is something which we late people cannot appreciate. For the Jew, it was the most outrageous thing, you see, to slay your firstborn who bore your name and who was your heir, to slay him, you see. This was what was demanded by God. And so he's just ready and holds his hand over the eyes of his son, and there's the angel with his marvelous large wings behind him, and he stays his hand. He grabs him on the wrist, and that's just that here. Wonderful etching, natural size. He has taken many scenes from the Old Testament. He has also taken scenes from the Apocrypha, that are these works which have not been included in the canon in Holy Scripture, but which are included, for instance, in the Luther Bible, between the Old and the New Testament. And one of these scenes which has always intrigued me no end is the angel leaving Tobias and his family. This is from the Apocrypha, because it shows the angel taking off as if he steps on the gas. I can't have the feeling that he's just get going, you see. And you see at the ground, you see the figures watching this fantastic supernatural event with different expressions. One in awe, one in complete bewilderment, stunned, and one in deep devotion. You see, it's all very, very interesting fabulous. But the way he depicts his angels from the rear, and the way in which he gives the idea of flight and take off, is absolutely fabulous to me. Now, after the Apocrypha comes then the New Testament. And naturally he has worked very much in New Testament scenes. And the interesting point is that Christ for him, and I'm very happy about it, Christ for him was truly human as long as he walked on the earth. He did not make the famous Superman, which I detest, you see, but he was true man and true God, but he was not true man-God. So he did not embellish him with all kinds of supernatural trappings. Yes, on a number of pictures he has a halo, a faint holy, but as a rule he is depicted in his humanity. Very interestingly, He has never drawn, or no, that's not true. He has never painted a Last Supper. He has not seen, he did not see Leonardo's Last Supper, which was famous, of course, all over the civilized world. It was painted when? At the end of the 15th century, and Rembrandt lived in the 17th century. He was not in Milan and didn't see it, but he saw engravings. Come back to what I told you first, made with the stylus and the plate, you see. He saw engravings of the Holy Supper, or at least one, and this excited him so much that he made three sketches, three drawings. So he, Rembrandt, who was one of the greatest artists of all times, did his own interpretation of Leonardo's Holy Supper. And Leonardo was one of the greatest artists of all time, and this is of no end fascination to me to see how one of the truly great interprets another truly great. So these sketches, which Rembrandt did just partly because he was fascinated by Leonardo's work, because he wished to interpret it this way, he put in his Rembrandtesque touches in these three sketches. He has painted no less than three times the confrontation at Emmaus, where he sat down at meal, and then the way he sat down and he prayed suddenly opened the eyes of the disciples, and some sit down there in complete devotion again, the other in amazement, and a servant at the rear, he brings in the bread and so on. He's completely unconcerned. He doesn't know what is going on. There are three versions, three beautiful versions, comparatively small, of the Emmaus. One is in the Louvre in Paris, which I've seen, and of which I've given a copy to our church. And so this is again very interesting. Yes, this was a scene which excited him to the point that he painted it, not only once, but three times. And none of it was a commission, you see, all on his own canvas, with his own paint, you see. But not Holy Supper. Now the various style elements. I hinted already in the beginning that he antagonized his clients by not painting them staring out of the frame, but he had movement. He had interesting and fascinating postures. In addition to that, as I just pointed out a moment ago, he had light. Here is an etching, which is, I don't like it too much. It is too baroque for my taste. It is too, but this is natural size. So you get some idea how these etchings are. And of course, the fabulous effects of brightest bright and darkest dark and semi-tones in between, all done by this etching technique, where you actually have only black and white. You have the suggestions of half-tone, but there are no half-tones which you can produce by this technique. And this is the angel appearing to the shepherds, you see, and all the company in heaven floating around, and the animal terrified, fleeing away, and the shepherds running as fast as they can. Rather interesting picture. And I got it, and I have it, of course, but I didn't frame it, I didn't give it anybody. So, the composition is a very typical part of his work. One group here, balanced against each other, central figure maybe in the middle, or a diagonal arrangement, as you have it here, and this Tobias, the angel leaving Tobias, where you have the diagonal lines going through the picture, and movement. Now, nobody can deny that's movement in this, nobody can deny that's their movement there. I wouldn't know where could there be greater movement. And color. I mentioned the color, and I showed you around here the Saskia flora, and you see there are colors, all right, and I mean this rather fanciful covering with varnish is something which was not discovered until the century. So color. And of course there's light and shadow. So these are light and shadow. Rembrandt is probably best known for his lighting effects, but it is only one of the fabulous elements of his work. Now finally, his appreciation. He was little appreciated by his contemporaries. First, yes, oh yes, when he came to Amsterdam, when his stars was in the ascending, fine. But when he antagonized the people by his own way of doing things, then, as I said before, his fame very quickly vanished. And he ended in not only in utter misery, but also practically forgotten. Doesn't take very long even for a famous man to get forgotten. And for two centuries, he was virtually completely forgotten. It was only in the last century that he was rediscovered, somewhat similar to Johann Sebastian Bach, who didn't mean very much to the Romantics, and who was rediscovered by Mendelssohn in the beginning of the 19th century. And so Rembrandt was revived the only last century, and now, of course, he is duly considered to be one of the towering giants of all times. I want to show you a number of things, partly black and white, partly in color. This is a picture. I just want to be sure that I don't mix up these patriarchs. This is Jacob. Jacob blesses his grandchildren. This hangs in Kassel, one of his marvelous works. I was there, saw it in 60, I don't know, 58, I think, or in 60. And then I was there once more in 62 with my daughter, and we specifically went to Kassel because I wanted to show her this Rembrandt, and I came to the museum was closed on one day, and oh, I was raving mad, and I never take no for an answer. I said, who has the key? Oh, he said, all right, get him. I said, well, I don't know where to find out, you see, you have a telephone book. And so I scared this guy, and in 5 minutes, this man was there, all scared. I said, please open the museum. Museum's closed. I said, please open it. And he opened it. He didn't say a thing. I said, please turn the, pull the curtains. He pulled the curtains. Here was the picture. And so Ludwig Roman and Christine, he looked at the picture. Everything was fine. He got a nice tip for me. He got a nice tip, and everybody was happy. So here's this picture. Here's this famous picture of a woman bathing, which is Henrike Stoffel, and while it could be very risque, it is done with the utmost restraint and not the slightest suggestion. I think it's marvelous work. Oh, here's the picture. I didn't find it. This is a woman caught in adultery. A very wonderful, famous work, again in London, in the National Gallery, where the woman in white is in the, like a spotlight falling on her. And Christ standing somewhat in the background with his long hair, with his brown, very, very simple, like monk-like garment. And then this fantastic, typically Rembrandtesque, Baroque, architecture in the background, and the two men who accuse her standing there with turbans and in all kinds of fanciful attire in the foreground. This is Man with a Golden Helmet, the most prized possessions of Berlin. When I came to Berlin as a little boy, there were two things which I looked at. This was the Nefertiti, the famous Egyptian queen, a limestone sculpture painted, absolutely fabulous work, and The Man with the Golden Helmet by Rembrandt, an equally famous and fabulous work. And when I saw it the last time, they had a spotlight, a hidden spotlight, which shone on the helmet, and it was brought out with such fabulous glittering glare and splendor, this golden helmet, that I said, did you do something to the picture? Did you clean it? And he smiled and he said, just watch. And then he pushed a button and everything fell into semi-darkness. So they had this spotlight which shone right on this picture and brought out the unbelievable livelihood and preciousness of this helmet, topping a very military face with a cropped mustache. Marvelous painting. Here's his son Titus, whom he had painted many times, which is in the Wallace collection in London, in a small private house of a lord who had collected art. And I was repeatedly in London without even knowing it. And finally I heard about the Wallace collection and I went there, and Titus is one of the most famous works there. Here are a number of old men. No, wait a minute, I want to show you this here. This is Peter denying Christ, which is again completely in these yellow, reddish, and brownish colors, which we happily now know may hide all kinds of other colors which will come or have come already to the fore. But even in this restriction to this various shades of brown, it is a very wonderful work. I talked yesterday about Christmas cards, if you were there, and I said I warned you, or rather I will discourage you to buy all this trash which is peddled again, with apologies by churches, just as well as by department stores and stationery stores. But you should go to the museums, to the various museums in this country, to the New York Public Library, and if you care to UNICEF, and get their Christmas cards. Now, this is here a Christmas card from the Metropolitan Museum of Art, and it is a reproduction of a Rembrandt etching. And this, I think, is the best gift you can give. It depicts the nativity, which is keep Christ in Christmas, and at the same time it is a work by Rembrandt. Nobody could give me greater pleasure than sending me a Rembrandt etching as a Christmas card. And the man who wrote that, he knows that. So that's why he sent it to me. Yes. Quite a few etchings of nativity scenes. Now here we come to a group, and this is the last that I want to show it to you. Then I can give this around too. And then I give this around too. These are a group of old men and old women. Now I think I belong a little bit into this category, and therefore I have a great appreciation for showing these old faces. And this work is of a magnificence which to me is absolutely unbelievable. I have a color photo and two black and white of the same. This is in London, in the National Gallery. And that's one of the first things I do in London, to go to the National Gallery. I would never go to London without going to the National Gallery and to look at my Rembrandts. Here is old man as St. Paul. And unfortunately, I have it only in black and white. But again, the physiognomy with which this face is painted is absolutely unexcelled. And here is an old woman. I have her close up in black and white and somewhat smaller in color, again in London. And here are the Tripps, both in their 80s. And I wouldn't know of any finer picture. It gives only a very faint suggestion, because the picture is large, life-size. The withered hands and the withered face and so on, but still the expression, absolutely fabulous. Absolutely fabulous, and that's her husband. A Polish merchant, a Jewish merchant, I mean, and he is in... That's in Kassel again, an old man, obviously not a Jew, with a cross hanging around his neck, and here's one of his self-portraits. Now I'd like to pass that around. That's in English, and it shows a few portraits and a few scenes in nativity, very, very nice. And here's a book which I have great pleasure of giving to Holden. I usually give a little gift each year, and these are etchings and drawings. The etchings, unfortunately, are not in natural size, that is, not all of them. Some are very definitely reduced, but some are in natural size. Now there's, for instance, the famous 100 Gilder print, which was called that way because Rembrandt considered it as one of his masterpieces, and he asked the price of 100 Gilder, which is $1,000, so for one print. And this is one of his most famous works. It is in this book, and it is rather small. Now, here you have the 100 Gilder print in the full size. This is a gravure reproduction, and it is, for all intents and purposes, indistinguishable of an original print. This was a gravure made from the print of the Metropolitan Museum. And it is called 100 Gilder print. Actually, it shows Christ healing the sick. And it depicts not only one scene, but it depicts several scenes which are reported in the 19th chapter of Matthew. And underneath this print, I have written the various scenes and incidents which are all composed into this picture. It is that not only the children are brought to Christ, at the left, you look at it later in greater detail, but also the sick and the lame and the halt, they carried in barrels to him. And then there's the rich young ruler to whom Christ had just said, well, if you give away everything and follow me, fine. And there he sits in a chair very pensively and looking, thinking that over and thinking, well, that's pretty tough, you see. So he's depicted in this position. And in addition to that, if this were not enough, then there are the Jewish rabbis or Pharisees or whoever they are discussing amongst themselves on the left side who this fellow is who stands so beautifully and domineeringly in the middle of this picture. It's a marvelous work, of course, and this gives you the true idea of the size and of the character. Here it is, right here, it's the reduction, and of course you lose very much by reducing it. But here you happily have the original size. And so this is the only comment I have regarding the etchings. The drawings are very, very nice because they are in the various media which Rembrandt used. So much of it is done with a brush, and some of them are in different colors. There is, for instance, one of their landscapes and all kinds of things. Here's a night scene, and there's one which I like particularly much, which is the return of the prodigal son. See where I find it. And I gave that to our church, too, a very fine reproduction in natural science. I think it's a marvelous picture, and this other brother who stayed home, he has such an insolent look. He looks on his father, well, he doesn't say anything, but his eyes, they speak a word. And the father, it's a son, it is an absolutely fabulous thing, and it's just a sketch. It is not even an etching, much less it is a painting, and it's a sketch which he sketched for himself, a drawing. Marvelous work. Okay, now we can still, we have little time, we can look at these various things. You can ask me questions. And after lunch, we go over and have this Rembrandt movie, which Holden was kind enough to secure for me just for this day. And today is the last day. Today is the thing has to go back. Holden pays penalty, so it all ties in very beautiful. Today is September 2nd. I could talk to you about Rembrandt. And after the coffee, we'll see this movie. Now, this movie, there are two comments. Number one, of course, it is for general consumption. So his religious work is not played up predominantly as we would like to do it here. You see, we are not so much interested in pigs and in beggars than in his religious work. But of course, this movie shows his work or the highlights of his work in its entirety. And the second comment, which I wish you keep in mind, is that these pictures were all taken before the varnish layers were removed. So all these pictures have this yellow brownish sheen, which is not Rembrandtesque, but this has been produced by the good intention of later generations who want to protect it. Of course, the varnish first was clear, you see, but it yellowed gradually. If the people had known that, they would practically ruin the picture by putting the stuff on so that you look everything like through a yellow filter, they probably wouldn't have done it. And now we have to remove it. Our experts have to remove it, which is a very delicate work. So that's all about I have to say. Any questions?
Ludwig?
Yeah.
Do you think that picture of Christ and the woman taken in adultery where the woman is in white,
do you think that Rembrandt understood it in terms of the Fruit of the Happy Exchange, the fact that Christ had taken her guilt and that she now stood free? I would not know that, whether there's an implied symbolism. It may very well be. I didn't interview Rembrandt, you see. I wouldn't know what he thought.
Well, it's funny because it's also true of I can't pronounce his name right, but the Spanish painter, Durbrand, who has this, we have this one excellent slide. Carol saw his paintings in Spain, and he was so taken with them. And there, Luke is looking at Christ on the cross, and the light is on Luke.
Yes.
And the shadow is on Christ on the cross.
Well, Remmert has, if I may say, played with these ideas. For instance, on the deposition from the cross, all the light falls on Mary as the bereaved mother, rather than on the dead body. The body is dead, so why just throw light on it? I mean, this was apparently...
But this one is Luke, the historian. It's more that Luke as the writer. He's not at the foot of the cross. This is a purely, this is really a portrait of Luke.
Yes.
By the Spanish painter, he's just simply portraying him. But I was thinking when you told about this about the woman taken in adultery and her standing in the light, you know. Because their sins are...
There may be very well some symbolic implication.
I never thought of that.
I'm
sure Rembrandt, because of the fact that he had to live so much into himself in his own meditation, probably had to absorb an awful lot of the gospel.
Oh, yes.
That's why it came out this way.
Quite likely, man. Very fascinating idea, which I never had before. Now, I gave our good... director little check, asking him to buy the work Rembrandt's paintings, which just came out this year in celebration of Rembrandt's 300 years of death, which he will do, of course. And so then the library will have the entire collected paintings, and they are reproduced in natural colors. How they do that, I don't know. I don't know whether all his paintings have been stripped of the Spanish layer. It may be that by some color contrasting processes, yellow has been eliminated in the color photography. I don't know that. Some pictures still have this yellow sheen, and by photographing them with the contrasting fillers, you get rid of this yellow. I don't know that. Maybe they have by now really all been, quote, cleaned, that is, stripped of this varnish. But at any rate, this book, quite expensive and heavy book, will have the paintings, all of Rembrandt's paintings, in their natural colors. And this book here has a number of etchings and a number of drawings, but sufficient to give a very representative idea of his marvelous work. So next year I think we will have that. But now happily we have this mule too.
I'd like to mention that when Ludwig Maurice was born, said he was going to give this book to the library at Holden, he said he was going to do it in honor of the appointment of his son to a particular professor there. And I thought, what a delightful way to celebrate.
Yeah, all kinds of pretexts you take to give a book to Holden. See? Yeah,
that's a great idea. I love that. Well, I mean, I like that, you know, the reason for doing it. I'm sure you would have done it anyway, but it's nice to have a special reason.
Okay. I didn't even put it in. I just said to Holden, a lay center for all the church, which impressed me very much. First of all, it is a lay center. I'm a layman, and both of you are laymen, and non-laymen are very welcome, as you know. And for all the church. That's not restricted to Lutherans or to one group of Lutherans, but to all the church. This broadening impressed me so much that I put it into this book on the first page. I think it's
Have you been to...